Your North Carolina Reading Service welcomes our blind and print-impaired listeners today to hear The Indie Week. This issue dated December 15th, 2021, and it's read by me, John Federson. I'm allowing just a little bit more time for our theme music today. We're actually in our cavernous broadcast studio 3 today. We rarely open the giant double doors. Even though I'm here all alone to read the Indie Week, today's musicians, known collectively as Hamsteria, are a huge grouping of those popular rodents, each one trained to squeak one unique pitch. Now, it takes upwards of 14 performers to accurately perform our theme music, and they're certainly doing well. 96 little compartments for our furry squeakettes, and they'll return at the end of our broadcast of Indie Week today. Thanks. And we'll get a-going with Lee Tauss's Raleigh Column, and this one titled Game Changer. The great general rule of thumb is it's hard to beat incumbents. Add to that the fact that the 2022 Raleigh municipal election is a nonpartisan race. Expect none of those helpful D's and R's next to the names. And that the Raleigh mayor and council races will appear at the bottom of a lengthy ballot. And you have a recipe for the current board's slate to slide with relative ease into another term. No one on council would have an easier time seeking re-election than Nicole Stewart. She received more votes than anyone on the council in 2019, including about 10,000 more votes than Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin. But instead of coasting to victory, Stewart says it's time to walk away. Last Tuesday, Stewart, 40, announced she will not run for re-election next year. She wrote in a statement, "Dear Raleigh, thanks for the privilege to serve. During my tenure, I'm proud of the progress we have made and believe now is the right time to let the next leader step up and serve our beloved city." Well, that news comes as a disappointment to those who have followed Stewart's political career. While her two terms on the council may seem relatively brief, her tenure saw her transition from the underdog on a council dead set on thwarting development to a member at the forefront of a sea change in Raleigh politics, ushering the city's future as a modern, dense, and vibrant metropolis. Baldwin praised Stewart for her intellectual, data-driven approach to governing, and she told the Indy, "What we're doing right now is so hard because we're going from a small city to a big city. It's a transition, and it's uncomfortable for some people because change is hard. People don't want to see change. But we are changing, and Nicole had that vision about where we needed to be and who we needed to be as a city." Under the previous council, that vision made Stewart often the sole voice of opposition. At the time, she was the council's youngest member at 37, and the council majority was composed of an older guard that prioritized preserving the past over making room for growth. While Mayor Nancy McFarlane and Councilmember Corey Branch sometimes tried to compromise and come to a consensus on issues, including on regulating short-term rentals and allowing ADUs, Stewart was unafraid to be the lone dissenting vote. For example, on issues such as a water and sewer rate increase she felt was inadequate, or against a proposal to eliminate a sidewalk plan at the behest of a few vocal residents for an inner-city neighborhood that had been in the works for years. Stewart's boldness made her stand out among the crowd in that 2019 election. She solidified a leadership position on the council when a new development-friendly board majority was sworn in that December and was appointed mayor pro tem. Stewart said her goal serving on council was, quote, to increase access to the decision-making table to help make our city council more diverse. among her accomplishments. Stewart says she's proud of helping to pass that $80 million affordable housing bond, supporting a goal to lower emissions 80% by 2050 to combat climate change, and stopping future development from being built in the floodplain. Stewart's exit from the council provides a big opportunity for a newcomer to run without the threat of facing off against a formidable incumbent. In an otherwise sleepy election year for the council, an open seat could shake things up considerably. In addition to serving on the council, Stewart also works full-time as development director for the NC Conservation Network. Prior to serving, she helped found the Beehive Collective, a giving circle that has raised more than $400,000 for local causes. Mayor Baldwin says, when you leave council, it doesn't mean you stop doing good. She'll find other ways to have a voice. We have her for another year, and I expect it'll be even stronger than it has been. It's a rare thing for an incumbent to step away at the top of their game. When asked if Stewart would consider returning to political life at some point down the road, she replied, I'm not ruling it out. Next, we turn to Tomasi McDonald. News from statewide. Collective care. Mission-driven. That's a term one hears often while speaking with the medical providers who care and treat many of the region's most economically vulnerable patients at Piedmont Health Services, PHS, which employs 600 people and operates 8 community health centers in Alamance, Caswell, Chatham, Lee, Orange, Person, and Randolph counties. Rupal Yu, a family physician who has worked with PHS since 2012, told the Indy last week, as medical providers, we are not focused on salaries. We're content with our salaries. The kind of people working at Piedmont Health aren't going to work for Duke Health. We care for patients who have very little, and we are trained to meet their needs to close those gaps in a powerful and meaningful way. The acceptance of relatively modest salaries notwithstanding, you, along with nearly 50 other physicians and medical providers at PHS, is focused on having a seat at the table. On November 23rd, PHS physicians and medical providers petitioned the National Labor Relations Board to form the Piedmont Health Services Providers United and submitted a petition to PHS CEO Brian Toomey that explained why they felt it was important to form a union. The petition noted that the petitioners are, quote, a diverse, united group of physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and nurse midwives who have chosen to work at this organization because of our alignment to the PHS mission to improve the health and well-being of the community by providing high-quality, affordable, and comprehensive primary health care. Chief among their concerns is not having a voice in organizational decisions that affect how they deliver patient care. The group stated in the position, quote, we see how our patients must overcome multiple hurdles to access our care. They suffer when basic clinic functions are neglected and staff experience burnout. We're tired of not having the time, tools, and support we need to do our work. Every time we fail to meet our patients' needs, we feel the pulse of our beloved PHS growing weaker. The group emphasized the importance of collective bargaining and asked Toomey to recognize our union. Toomey could not be reached for comment, but the same day the petition was filed with the NLRB, PHS responded by hiring Ogletree, Deacons, Nash, Smoak, and Stewart, a powerhouse law firm with a national reputation for union busting. This spring, Duke University officials hired that law firm after Duke University Press employees announced their intention to form a union. Ogletree Deacons was a formidable opponent, but the DUP workers prevailed. Sandra Korn, an assistant editor with DUP, told Indy this week, this fall, the National Labor Board ruled in our favor. The workers won the vote, but Duke has not yet recognized us. So at the moment, we're without legal recognition. It's as if their anti-union law firm will pull some legal feat to delay as long as possible. It's like Ogletree Deacon's business model is to intimidate workers and prevent people from having the power in the workplace that they deserve. PHS Providers Union members are awaiting the outcome of a pre-election hearing this Tuesday, that's tomorrow, with Ogletree Deacon's attorneys at the NLRB offices in Winston-Salem. Michaela McCuddy, a family medicine doctor at the PHS Center in Siler City, told the Indy. And she said it's occurring because Mr. Toomey refuses to recognize our supermajority outright, and the purpose is to sort out the details of our election. We find it reprehensible, said you, that our management is squandering our precious resources to delay our election. We're ready to have elections. We're ready to vote, and that needs to be done. We have work that needs to be done with patients that need our care, and this is a needless distraction and delay. Ogletree Deacon's officials were not available for comment. PHS's seemingly anti-union stance appears counterintuitive to its origins. A little over half century ago, as a federally qualified health center that's eligible for reimbursement under Medicare and Medicaid. Agencies like PHS function as a medical safety net that offers high-quality primary care regardless of a patient's ability to pay, according to ruralhealthinfo.org. Company officials on the PHS website note that the health care provider was started in 1970 by UNC Chapel Hill health care professionals and community members who were concerned about access to primary health care in their communities. Then known as Orange Chatham Comprehensive Health Services, the organization placed, according to its website, special emphasis on those who weren't receiving proper health care and who lacked access to services. Piedmont's mission is why you, a family physician and UNC Chapel Hill Medical School graduate, started working at PHS's Carrboro Clinic after completing her residency with UNC Family Medicine. She was attracted to PHS because of its reputation as one of the largest providers of community health services in the country and its mission of inclusiveness that translates into 50,000 people being treated each year. You said, "The majority are uninsured. I worked there at two clinics as a medical student and really looked up to the physicians and medical providers I worked with, who are all brilliant and dedicated. So I knew I wanted to come here after my training. It was a no-brainer because I'm mission-driven." McCuddy echoed Yu's sentiment about PHS. "I always wanted to be here and work in this specific community in Siler City." She said she decided to work in rural Spanish-speaking Latinx communities while attending UNC Medical School. That's also when she first became aware of PHS. She explained, "I wanted to bring care where it's needed most. I love rural medicine. As a doctor, it's like I'm part of the family in some regards. You can be a pillar in the community in so many different realms, inside and outside the clinic." She said a close friend told her about an opening at PHS Siler City Clinic. She said, "Siler City is close to me. I felt compelled. I felt like, yes, this is where I want to be." Krishna Kothari is a family nurse practitioner who earned her advanced degree in nursing from Johns Hopkins University. In 2018, she began working at PHS Siler City and Carrboro Clinics. Along with being a primary care physician, her expertise is in addictions, gender-affirming care, and HIV care. For her, PHS was a natural fit, and Kothari told the Indy last week, "Community health is where my heart and soul is for all of my career. It's a mission that I wanted to be part of. I'm passionate about caring for underserved communities." She says the work is about treating high-risk patients who are challenged by a complexity of barriers, including economic and language obstacles, particularly in Siler City, where she treats a significant number of Spanish-speaking patients. she said. Those barriers can affect their health and also affect their ability to obtain health care. There are these social determinants of health: unsafe neighborhoods with poor air quality, intergenerational trauma, poverty, a kid living in poverty whose asthma is worse because of poor housing, or a relative who smokes. It's what I treat every day. But the medical providers who spoke with the Indy say PHS has strayed from its roots. They point to workplaces where they have no input in decisions that affect the lives of their patients and their own, where they feel bullied when they ask for change, and where there exists high employee turnover because of frustration, increased workloads, and cuts in their own health coverage. McKinney said that even though the Siler City Clinic is exactly where she wants to be because people bring so much passion to their work, she's beginning to see issues with their ability to retain its employees. She says people want to be there. They feel supported by the other providers, but they don't have a voice in the organization. Every other week or every 3 weeks, someone leaves, and people are sad to be leaving. They want to be here. You said frustration has been, quote, building up quite a while among her colleagues. She added that these frustrations have been exacerbated by the pandemic. In addition to a lot of staff turnover, she decried patterns of poor management by managers who don't have the expertise or support to do their job. You said, we need to have a mechanism in place to raise issues. The issues are many. The problem is we have no mechanism. We need to have a seat at the table. Kotari said the PH system is, quote, an added barrier to barriers that our patients already have. One of the main reasons I want a union is to have a say in the system. A lot of medical providers apologize to their patients for the system. There's not one day I don't apologize for the system. She added that it's one thing to apologize to her patients because of the crappy lives they have to endure, and quite another to apologize for a system that's supposed to help them but feels more like it's exploitative. Quote, my heart is breaking at this point at how the system represents itself and has become a hindrance. You said that as agents of nonprofit healthcare centers, PHS medical providers, quote, have an obligation to serve our vulnerable population with dignity and respect. And we believe a strong medical provider's voice will create stability and enhance our mission and make Piedmont Health a better place for all. Now, this next article by Taylor Knopf was, like several in the Indy Week from time to time, pre-published already in NC Health News. And it's called Off Target. One of the largest allocations for substance use disorder treatment in the recently enacted state budget, $10 million, is going to a new nonprofit set up by a church in Robeson County, home to one of the most powerful Republicans in the state Senate. The nonprofit called Hope Alive Incorporated is a ministry of Greater Hope International Church in Lumberton. Its lead pastor, Ron Barnes, told his congregation during a Sunday service in November, which was live streamed on Facebook, that Hope Alive received a grant to open, quote, an 82-bed drug addiction rehab facility. There's no evidence on the six-year-old church's website to suggest it has experience in treating addiction disorders, and the church failed to respond to multiple media requests for details of the nonprofit's plans. More than 100,000 Americans died of drug overdose during the pandemic between April 2020 and April 21, the largest number recorded for a 12-month period, according to the latest data from the Centers for Disease Control. Substance use experts agree that at a time when a record-breaking number of people are dying of drug overdoses, state money should be directed to clinics and organizations with a track record of providing evidence-based addiction treatment, including medication-assisted treatment, This is called MAT, medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorder. Providing MAT to patients requires special medical licensing, which many church-run drug treatment programs do not have. Jamie Carter, primary care and addiction medicine physician at Lincoln Community Health Center in Durham, says it's really infuriating to see $10 million going somewhere that doesn't have any details attached to it. At Carter's facility, which didn't receive money from the state budget for addiction treatment, patients historically would miss MAT appointments because they struggled to scrounge up the $10 needed for their copay. Currently, her patients' copays are being covered by a temporary grant set to expire next year, but she said there are patients at other community health centers in the state that still struggle to afford copays. Quote, that amount of money, $10 million, could cover the cost of copays for patients throughout all the community health centers in the state for years, I would imagine. It's unclear what kind of treatment Hope Alive will provide with that $10 million grant. North Carolina Health News reached out to Greater Hope International Church multiple times by phone, email, and Facebook to learn more details about the plans for its drug treatment facility, but no one responded at the time of this publication. NC Health News sought information about Hope Alive from the office of State Senate Leader Phil Berger, Republican 30th District, which led the budget negotiations for the chamber. His office directed us to State Senator Danny Britt, Republican 13th, since it's in his district. Britt is a rising Republican star who has said he's considering a run for the statewide office of Attorney General in 2024. He also has not responded to multiple email, phone, and text message requests for comment on this story. Pastor Barnes said he established Hope Alive in July of 2020 because the Lord spoke to him through prayer and told him, quote, to form a separate benevolence outreach ministry. He explained from the church pulpit as music played and the worship team swayed behind him. Both entities used the same mailing address. While Hope Alive has no website, Greater Hope International Church has a prolific online presence. The church and Barnes have a very active Facebook pages with thousands of friends and followers, a YouTube channel, an Instagram account, and a radio broadcast in Robeson County. Barnes is Facebook friends with Senator Britt and several other Brits. The pastor doesn't appear to be connected on Facebook to the two other state lawmakers who represent Robeson County in the legislature. And he told his congregation after that budget deal was announced, quote, God said, I'm going to do something to blow people's mind. And let me tell you something. My mind got blown this week. There's been some work going on, and we've been doing some things. But Hope Alive was granted $11 million, that's an error, for drug rehab. During that Sunday morning announcement, Barnes did not include that the grant was from the state government. Quote, don't take me as bragging, but yes, I am. No other church, no other ministry in this county has ever stepped out on faith like this. God is honoring our faith. Robeson County certainly has a need for substance use treatment services. The county had the highest rate of emergency department visits for drug overdoses in the state last year, 495 per 100,000 people, and the second highest rate of overdose death at 62 per 100,000 people. The Robeson RCORP Consortium, a more established organization aimed at treating addiction in Robeson County, received $2.2 million from the state budget. It's not uncommon for the state legislature to give isolated grants to groups with Christian affiliations aimed at helping people with substance use disorders or to fund other special projects. The News and Observer created an interactive graph that shows which counties received the $3.1 billion in earmarks this budget cycle. Much of the funding allocated by earmark this year is the result of federal COVID relief dollars passed by Congress in March. According to a Supreme Court ruling, religious groups cannot use taxpayer funds for anything, quote, inherently religious, but Funds can be used for non-religious social services. Several other groups throughout North Carolina, both religious and non, received one-time grants to provide resources and services to people with substance use disorders. Most of the larger allocations are designated for the opening of new addiction treatment facilities. MATs such as methadone and buprenorphine are well documented to greatly reduce opioid overdose deaths and help people with opioid use disorder live normal lives. However, many of the groups receiving state money rely on older abstinence-based approaches to addiction recovery and don't offer MAT. For example, the Brunswick Christian Recovery Center received $1.1 million from the state budget for a new treatment facility, and the organization's website says it doesn't offer, quote, conventional drug and alcohol treatment or MAT services. Our program is designed to encourage recovery by developing a relationship with Jesus Christ and working the 12-step program. Alex Gertner, MD, PhD candidate at UNC School of Medicine and the Gillings School of Global Public Health, says, quote, I know the General Assembly cares a lot about the overdose crisis, so I would hope and I would think that they would allocate funds to existing, established, legitimate, credible, evidence-based programs. Gertner has published multiple research articles and conducted award-winning research in the field of opioid use disorder and treatment. Quote, so when I see money going to places that no one's heard of and places that don't provide gold standard care, it worries and concerns me. State lawmakers have increased funding to address addiction issues over the past several years due to the rising level of drug overdose deaths, Gertner said. There's no wrong road to recovery. So people find and use all kinds of resources when they're dealing with addiction. For some people, that can be church. For some people, that can be camping. It could be family, golf, you know, whatever. People find support. They find meaning in lots of different activities. While these activities, he said, can be helpful, they are not treatment. Quote, when we allocate money to deal with serious illnesses like diabetes, cancer, heart disease, we generally give it to proven evidence-based programs, and that's what we should do for addiction. Opioid addiction treatment that doesn't use MAT has a 90% failure rate, said Gertner, citing a study published in the Journal of American Medical Psychiatry. Quote, what's worse is that it can be harmful because when someone who has an addiction stops using opioids for a short period of time and then returns to using opioids, which is often what happens in abstinence-based approaches, it increases the risk of overdose. So what we don't want to do is fund programs that could actually put people at a higher risk of overdose and death. Over the last several years, an increasing number of street drugs contain fentanyl, an opioid that's much stronger than heroin or morphine, which makes returning to drug use after a period of abstinence much more deadly. And Colin Miller, the co-founder of Twin City Harm Reduction Collective in Winston-Salem, says, we know that we're just throwing millions of dollars towards ineffective detox and abstinence-based methods for a population that has single-digit success rates when we use these methods. Miller said he has a history of homelessness and drug use and in the past went through an abstinence-based residential treatment program in Winston-Salem as an alternative to a jail sentence. However, MAT has been more effective for Miller. He's now on Sublocade, a monthly shot of long-release buprenorphine. He said state lawmakers need to allocate money, quote, intelligently into what is actually evidence-based. It's just crazy to see the same crap year after year as the overdose rate just continues to climb. There are tight regulations around providing MAT that prevent some well-established programs from administering the medication to participants. Miller said the abstinence programs instead rely heavily on that 12-step recovery model. quote, and you're constantly told that abstinence is the only way and that it's not real recovery if you're on MAT. Carter, a primary care and addiction medication provider in Durham, said she is horrified that those programs don't give participants the option to receive MAT. Quote, I think these programs have a moral and ethical obligation to be offering and educating anyone who comes to them who's asking for treatment about the options that are the standard of care. If a program doesn't provide MAT, they need to give participants an option to receive it, even if that means driving participants to a facility that does, she said. While program funding to address substance use disorder plays a crucial role in treating addiction, it's not the only piece of the puzzle. According to Sarah Potter, Director of Addiction Professionals of North Carolina, quote, increasing funding does not improve the system's infrastructure. The reality is that the behavioral health workforce is dwindling due to secondary trauma and burnout, she said. Potter noted that overdose deaths have continued to rise for the last 15 years, but she said the workforce cannot keep up with the demand. Quote, funding is only as good as you have professionals to help. With a significant strain on our frontline addiction and mental health workers who are traditionally overworked and underpaid, our workforce is in dire need of help. Yes, more funds are needed, but the field cannot use the funds effectively without a sufficient number of healthy and capable workers. She applauded state lawmakers for increased addiction funding in the budget, but criticized them for the nearly 5 months delay in approving the funds, she said. While legislators went back and forth with negotiation, service providers went without much needed support, delaying projects and work across the state. Another reprint of a column, this time from a publication called North Carolina Health News. This is by Elizabeth Thompson, and it's titled Unreported. Around 8 p.m. on Monday, November 22nd, a man incarcerated at the Alamance County Jail was found unresponsive. Jail staff administered naloxone, an opioid overdose reversal drug, and he was transported to Cone Health Alamance Regional Medical Center, according to the jail. This man, Craig Hodge, overdosed on drugs, according to the jail incident report. He survived his overdose. Less than an hour later, jail staff found a second man unresponsive, a 21-year-old named Gerard Barnes. Staff and local emergency medical services were unable to revive Barnes. He died. At the time of the jail's press release, Barnes' official cause of death had not been announced by a medical examiner. That investigation could confirm whether Barnes also overdosed. That same day, a third man incarcerated in the Alamance jail, Torrey Jamel Heath, was found in possession of a baggie, according to the jail, quote, containing a small amount of powder substance which tested positive for fentanyl. He was charged with a felony for possession of drugs on jail property. Alamance County Detention Center spokeswoman Michelle Mills confirmed that another person had also been found unresponsive 2 days before Barnes died, but she couldn't confirm whether that person overdosed. She said in an email, as far as I know, we didn't receive a toxicology report on that inmate, so there is limited information that can be released. While there was an incident report for the overdose that occurred before Barnes died, Mills said, incident reports are not necessarily written up every time it is suspected a person might have overdosed. She said incident reports are for crimes, so they wouldn't necessarily have an incident report. It may just be medical records for that inmate. The cluster of overdoses at that Alamance jail comes at a time when there have been a record number of overdose deaths in the United States and in North Carolina. An average of more than 8 North Carolinians died every day of 2020 from a drug overdose, according to the NC Department of Health and Human Services. from 2000 to 2020, more than 28,000 North Carolinians died of a drug overdose. There has been movement at the state and national level to help people with opioid use disorder, as I just read in the previous article, including funds in the state budget for addiction treatment and recovery and settlement money coming into North Carolina as a result of Attorney General Josh Stein's lawsuit against major opioid manufacturers. But people with opioid use disorder often end up in jail rather than receiving treatment. Federal data shows that as much as 85% of the prison population either has a substance use disorder or was arrested for crimes related to drug use. In the state's jails, which are controlled by county sheriffs and often lack comprehensive oversight, opioid overdoses are not uncommon. Local jail deaths due to drugs or alcohol intoxication have more than quadrupled across the country from 2000 to 2018, according to national data. Evan Eshkin, professor of family medicine, UNC School of Medicine, previously told NC Health News, "We incarcerate people for the crime of mental illness and the crime of substance use disorder." But it's almost impossible to know the total number of incarcerated people who overdose. While overdose deaths that occur in jails are reported in North Carolina, the number of non-fatal drug overdoses in jail is almost impossible to track. Jails often have to wait for a myriad of different reports to come back to truly identify an actual cause of death, said Luke Woolard, attorney for Disability Rights North Carolina. An autopsy with a toxicity screening is required to rule a death as an overdose. It's most common for a person to overdose if they have entered the jail soon after consuming drugs, said Woolard. For example, a person may have ingested a large amount of drugs to try and hide them upon their arrest. If staff does not check on them, they can die in a cell alone. It's also possible, but less common, for someone to bring drugs into the jail and die from overdose. Methods of treating people with substance use disorders is also inconsistent in the state's jails. Some jails provide MAT, medical-assisted treatment, where detainees are allowed to continue taking or are prescribed medications, such as methadone or buprenorphine, which allow people with use disorders to get off harmful street drugs without going through withdrawal. Other jails offer no such treatment, forcing people into withdrawal while in custody. Opioid withdrawal usually looks like a flu-like illness, including symptoms such as vomiting and diarrhea, which can lead to dehydration. It's an unusual occurrence, but left untreated, people can die from those symptoms. Woolard said, "Somebody comes in, and the ones we see, often they're either noted as being in Percocet withdrawal or some sort of withdrawal, and it's the same issue. They have serious medical problems over a number of days and then eventually just sort of succumb to them." Forcing people through withdrawal also lowers their tolerance over time. This can be a problem once people are released, said Susan Pollitt, supervising attorney for DRNC. A study by UNC Chapel Hill researchers found that incarcerated people in North Carolina were 40 times more likely to die of an opioid overdose within the first 2 weeks after release than someone in the general population. There's another complication to tracking how many people overdose in jail. If the person dies outside of the jail facility, whether because they were quickly discharged or en route to the hospital, the jail staff does not generate a report. Woolard says, "We take a lot of steps to try and stop this, but still a fairly common thing for jails to try and take somebody who died from suicide or overdose, get them while they're in really bad shape but en route to a hospital, try and get them posted bail or something so they can say they weren't in custody to avoid all of this reporting that they've had to do." Adding, as said, Pollitt said, "And if there is a suicide attempt or overdose that doesn't result in death, no documents are generated." after a 17-year-old died in Mecklenburg Jail, North Juvenile Detention Center, State Representative Carla Cunningham, Democrat of Mecklenburg, started to research jail deaths due to inadequate medical care. She said in an interview with NC Health News, "I started looking at it closely and saw that, yes, these things were happening in facilities, and that it really is not a lot of oversight or a collection of the data. The information is there, but you've got to dig for it." She filed a bill at the state legislature in May, which would have required the State Department of Health and Human Services to conduct compliance reviews following reports of an attempted suicide. Cunningham, a registered nurse, said that in health professions, preventative measures are paramount to reducing harm. If someone comes into a medical setting who's suicidal, health professionals know to be on high alert, but jail staff might not have the medical training that nurses do. Cunningham said, "That is still a responsibility that they have, and if they aren't able to fulfill that, then someone else needs to be stepping in and helping them understand the training, helping understand how to apply it, and understand how to be more preventative in those steps." Cunningham's bill went nowhere this year. She said that one reason it may not have moved forward through the legislative process could be because some legislators didn't want to put additional stressors on sheriffs. Cunningham said she doesn't consider having more of a paper trail to be a stressor. She noted data is key in the medical field. "Without comprehensive data on overdoses in the state's jails, it's hard to tell how many close calls there have been, which is a problem, even as overdose deaths tick up across the state, partly due to the introduction of fentanyl into the drug supply. More powerful drugs like fentanyl mean a greater risk for a fatal overdose in jail. The public will get a record then, but that means another person will be dead." Next, an article from Lynn Bonner titled "Due Process," which article was originally published at NC Policy Watch. State courts are wading into the bare-knuckle fight over new congressional and legislative districts that Republicans say are just fine, but Democrats and outside evaluators argue are heavily skewed to the GOP's advantage. Three lawsuits have been filed against the redistricting plans. The NC League of Conservation Voters is challenging the congressional and legislative districts, saying the plans are unconstitutional, partisan gerrymanders, and dilute minority votes. North Carolina voters tend to split their choices about evenly in Democrats or Republicans, but Republicans will win 9 or 10 of the state's 14 congressional seats, even if voter preferences shift significantly toward Democrats, the lawsuit says. Civil rights groups are also suing. The North Carolina NAACP Common Cause of North Carolina lawsuit claims the state House and Senate maps were drawn improperly because Republicans did not consider whether they should create districts that comply with the Federal Voting Rights Act. And a group of voters backed by the National Redistricting Foundation claim in their lawsuit that the congressional plan is, quote, "an extreme and brazen partisan gerrymander of the kind that forced the legislature to redraw district lines in 2019. Last week, justices on North Carolina's Supreme Court ordered the state's primary election move from March the 8th to May the 17th in order to give the court time to hear the complaints. The trial will run from January 6th through the 8th, with a verdict from the court scheduled to come down on January 11th. These legal challenges are familiar territory for North Carolina. Between 2011 and 2019, courts required state lawmakers to redraw district lines several times to correct racial or partisan gerrymanders. Attorneys in the most recent redistricting lawsuits asked to speed up the appeals process by skipping the state court of appeals and taking the cases directly to the state's highest court. Governor Roy Cooper and Attorney General Josh Stein, both Democrats, asked the state Supreme Court last week if it could support the request for, quote, discretionary review or to bypass the Court of Appeals in the cases filed by the League of Conservation Voters and the National Redistricting Foundation-backed plaintiffs. Republicans adopted gerrymandered districts, quote, improperly entrenching themselves and their political party in office, says their court brief. The Cooperstein brief continues, this case raises profound issues of constitutional law that go to the heart of our state's ability to function as a democracy. Partisan gerrymandering, exacerbated by today's technology, allows legislative majorities to entrench themselves in power without regard to the popular will. It prevents the people from meaningful exercising their sovereign authority to select their representatives and to thereby ensure that the state's policies reflect the views of the people as a whole. Attorneys in the lawsuits filed by the National Redistricting Foundation and Civil Rights Group have asked that Justice Phil Berger, Jr. be disqualified from participating in the case. Justice Berger's father, Senate Leader Phil Berger, Sr., is a named defendant in redistricting lawsuits. Motions last week to have Justice Berger disqualified mirror a similar request made by plaintiffs in a voter ID case pending before the court, in which Senator Berger is also a defendant. The request that Berger and Justice Tamara Berenger, a former state senator, step down has prompted a sometimes heated public debate over judicial conflicts of interest. Senator Berger is often named in lawsuits challenging legislative actions by virtue of his position as Senate leader. But in their motion, lawyers for the civil rights group say that Senator Berger is more than a nominal defendant, having appointed the redistricting committee and helped pick lawyers representing legislators. Hillary Harris Klein said in an interview, "We believe this is an exceptional case where it's not a mere formality." She is a lawyer with the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, who's representing the civil rights groups. The North Carolina Judicial Code of Conduct says justices should recuse themselves when they are related to a party in a case. "We believe that's a clear conflict," said Klein. Klein said the recusal request does not have to delay consideration of the case. The civil rights groups are suing over legislative districts, claiming that Republican mapmakers did not consider a need to draw districts that comply with the Federal Voting Rights Act, as a state Supreme Court ruling from the early 2000s requires. In redistricting committee meetings this year, Republicans said they didn't use racial or partisan data in creating the district plans. Philip Strach, a lawyer for Republican legislators, said in a hearing last month that GOP lawmakers did comply with that earlier court ruling and that Voting Rights Act districts, quote, were not required because of the long litigation history that preceded this redistricting. Of paramount importance is that voters, when they go to the polls, are able to exercise their rights on equal terms, said Klein. Independent evaluators, including the Princeton Gerrymandering Project, have determined the plans skew in favor of Republicans, and they gave each of the three redistricting plans an F for partisan fairness. In a court hearing earlier this month, a lawyer representing the Republican lawmaker said the maps look the way they do because Republican voters are spread across the state, while Democratic voters are concentrated in higher population counties. A lawyer for the National Redistricting Foundation-backed plaintiffs countered that the congressional plan intentionally packs Democrats into a handful of districts and parcels them out to other districts with heavy Republican majorities, where they don't have a chance of influencing election outcomes. Voters in the state's largest heavily Democratic counties, Wake, Mecklenburg, and Guilford, are divided among three districts. Guilford does not have a self-contained congressional district. Its votes are split among three districts that all have Republican majorities, says the lawsuit. The League of Conservation Voters lawsuit asks the court to order the state to use its proposed maps produced by computer algorithms. The League of Conservation Voters wants them to use its proposed maps produced by algorithms if the legislature doesn't redraw districts in time for the primary 2022. One of the reasons the league offered its own maps was to show that the legislature could have created fairer maps while complying with traditional redistricting principles. And the lawsuit says the General Assembly cannot claim that North Carolina's political geography or state law compelled the skewed results that these enacted plans yield. All right, let's move to food and drink. Talk about the new restaurant in Clayton, North Carolina, of all places, Crawford's Cook Shop. And I'll read what time permits left in this article written by Lena Geller. According to Mayor Jody McLeod, the town of Clayton has been trying to get a Chick-fil-A for a decade. She says this has literally been a goal of the town council. On the record, a goal, and we can't get it because we don't have enough people in a 5-mile radius. So, when 5-time James Beard Award semifinalist Scott Crawford announced he would be opening a new restaurant in the Raleigh suburb, McLeod was thrilled, saying of all the places he could have chosen to invest, he chose Clayton. It puts us on the map. Crawford, the celebrated chef owner of the downtown Raleigh's Crawford and Sons and Jolie, as well as the upcoming Crawford Brothers, that's a steakhouse slated to open in Fenton Development in Cary, in 2022, launched his third restaurant, Crawford Cook Shop, 2 weeks ago in downtown Clayton. For someone who has spent his career working at big city restaurants, Crawford's decision to open the cook shop in a town with just under 30,000 residents was an unexpected change of pace. But because Clayton is one of the fastest growing towns in North Carolina, its population has nearly doubled since 2010, McLeod says it makes sense that Crawford would want to put down roots, saying, Clayton's getting so big that I can literally go to Walmart and not worry about what I look like because I don't know anybody in there. How awesome is that? He says Clayton's growth trajectory helped draw him to the location, but ultimately the community's warmth and hospitality sealed the deal. Quote, the more time I spent down here, the more I fell in love with it. The people are so nice and welcoming. I grew up in a smaller town where people respect each other and support each other. This reminded me of that. And despite Clayton's burgeoning population, McLeod says the influx of new residents hasn't detracted from its small town feel. Quote, it used to be that everybody who lived here grew up in Clayton. Now we have new Claytonians and old Claytonians. That weave is creating a tremendous sense of community. Crawford Cook Shop is housed in the former J.G. Barber and Sons Hardware Building, which was built in the early 20th century and stands on Clayton's Main Street. Crawford renovated the building in a way that, similar to the town's populace, intertwines the past and the present. Working with the architect Louis Cherry, he put his own modern stamp of clean lines on the space, while also honoring the history of what McLeod says is the oldest structure in downtown Clayton. After discovering a hand-powered rope pulley elevator in the bowels of the building, Crawford and Cherry took it apart and incorporated its wood and gears into the restaurant's decor. Quote, while we were remodeling the building, we wanted to respect and preserve the era it came from. But elevator gears are far from the only repurposed aspect of Crawford Cook Shop. The restaurant was born out of the pandemic, a member of the food industry's rare children of the corn, if you will. Oh, my God. Children of the corn. With a menu that Crawford originally created while adapting his flagship restaurant to curbside-only service during that first lockdown. When restaurants closed in March of 2020, Crawford and his team spent several days conceiving an entirely new menu for Crawford & Sons because, he says, the items on the restaurant's pre-COVID menu were too composed to be packaged to go. He says, we sat down and said, what travels well? What's going to comfort people? We came up with this classic Americana elevated comfort food that was really in line with what we cooked every day, but more casual. After a few months, Crawford and his customer base grew so fond of the curbside menu that he decided it had earned its own brick-and-mortar spot. And in December of 2020, Crawford & Sons reopened for indoor dining, reinstating the carefully plated, temperature-sensitive dishes it offered before the pandemic. And almost exactly 1 year later, an iteration of Crawford & Sons' box-friendly menu resurfaced at the Crawford Cook Shop in Clayton. When it comes to high-end restaurants, the word casual often has elastic applications. Crawford, for example, categorizes Crawford & Son as a casual neighborhood eatery, and the cookshop as a totally more casual than his previous restaurants. It's true that it does deviate from his standard cuisine in a number of ways. Unlike his other two restaurants, the cookshop's menu includes snacks, sandwiches, and wings, as well as three kid-friendly dishes. That being said, the food is still distinctly upscale and a far cry from casual Chick-fil-A fare. One of the snacks is rabbit roulettes, and the server will likely encourage you to get the duck wings rather than the chicken. Crawford says he aimed to make this restaurant less expensive than his first two, and through the sandwiches, which range from $14 to $18, and though those sandwiches make the cook shop's entrees slightly more accessible, the rest of the menu prices are essentially on par with Crawford & Son and Jolie. In a nutshell, the cook shop is more casual in that its menu and ambience are less formal than their Raleigh counterparts, but also in that its beef tartare is $15 and Jolie's is $16. But regardless of the way he categorizes it, Crawford's cooking is as exquisite as ever, and it's particularly delightful to try the handful of menu items that are genuinely more modest than his usual creations. Notably, the smoked fish dip with pickles and fried saltines, and the spicy fried chicken sandwich with a fermented pepper sauce and miso slaw, as their execution is equally impressive as the higher-end dishes, and they allow Crawford's skills to shine in a way that feels fresh. Well, here are our hamsters again telling me that it's time to get out and somebody better feed us some lettuce darn quick. Well, they did a great job, so we'll congratulate them. And John Federson closing this edition of Indie Week. And hopefully we will get to you in about 1 week's time with the next edition. So long.